is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, the creator of the show and your host. Recently, I've not been releasing shows that I usually do. That is, typically I do interviews with book authors. Today's show is another exception, but well worth a listen nevertheless because it comes from the recent Taylor University colloquium. This time it's the panel discussion with the main keynote speakers, Diana Glier, Colin Duryea, and Serena Higgins. If you attended this 2016 event, then you know there was another special guest, the co-author of a book called The Fellowship, who joined in via Google Hangouts. Unfortunately, the quality of the audio for most of her comments were not audible on my recording, so all of what she said has been removed for this podcast. Finally, the host of the session was Joe Rickey, who is professor of English and director of the Center for the Study of C.S. Lewis and Friends at Taylor.
What we're trying to do here today is talk in general with all of us together, and at the end, of course, we'll have some question and answer time about the future of inkling studies and probe, you might say, the future. But I thought, first of all, I'd ask each of the panelists, and we'll start with Diana, who are the authors and or what are the works that proved sort of foundational to you, maybe to get you going in this direction or heading you in a direction that has been fruitful? Just let's sort of pay homage, as it were, to some of the people who have been meaningful to us, and perhaps inkling scholars, perhaps not, perhaps something else that helped you to help form your thinking in this area. Okay? Is that all right, Diana?
Absolutely. Very exciting to be here today. It is a daunting task to try to think of just a few titles, right, that are significant, especially titles aside from those of the primary texts. One of the things that I spend a lot of time talking about and encouraging young scholars is the importance of doing primary research, because it's important for us to talk with one another about our various interpretations. But the more we can encourage one another to go back to the original documents, right, and to see what the inklings have to say, and to read between the lines of how this may have been misunderstood. I think it's incredibly important for us to constantly be checking back and forth. And that's why I am so grateful for every archivist and library in this room. You are our heroes. You make it possible for us to do what we do. Let me mention two books that have been very influential to my thinking, I guess. When it comes to Lewis studies, one of my favorites still, one of the most important books that I've ever read in Lewis studies is C.S. Lewis at the Breakfast Table by Como. It's that particular collection. What you see there is you see an assortment of perspectives, and one of the reasons that book is so important to me is the very fact that there's so much in there that is contradictory. And I think that that's helpful and healthy in our field, to have a variety of perspectives, and instead of striving for an artificial consistency, what James Como has done in that book is allowed these individual voices to speak clearly from their individual perspectives. And I think that that's a model for healthy intellectual community, the ways in which we extend intellectual hospitality to a variety of perspectives and voices. So I love that book, and I reread it frequently. I think it's still good. I wish he hadn't revised it. Because when he revised it, I think he tried to make the seams even out a little bit. And I don't think that was an advantage. I like the original version of that very much. So that's a Lewisian book that's been very important to me. A book from another field would be a book by Goran Hermerin called Influence in Art. And just this whole question, I'll talk about this a little bit in my address tonight. This idea of what counts as influence. And tonight, if you're there and get to hear me speak, I'll be issuing a warning. I think that we view influence much too narrowly, and I think that we need to think much more capaciously about what we're looking at and what we're looking for when it comes to the question of influence. So I'll talk a little bit more about that another time. Thanks.
Thanks, Diana. Thank you. Colin.
What put me onto the Inklings, really, was discovering C.S. Lewis. but it was when I read His Surprise by Joy fairly early on. I was just finished high school then. I came across all these names like Tolkien and others. And then shortly afterwards, I was in Istanbul starting to study there, and I met a few Americans. One of them lent me Essays Presented to Charles Williams, and I read the introduction. Yes. To that by C.S. Lewis about the Inklings, mm-hmm. which in fact included Dorothy L. Sayers as well. You know, but I soon realised that she wasn't allowed to be an Inkling. and then a bit after that, I was in Northern Ireland continuing my studies, and somebody told me that a chap called Humphrey Carpenter was writing a book about the Inklings, and started to think that that's something that I wanted to explore. And that really led me to start writing on the Inklings. But there wasn't actually a book to help me until I read Humphrey Carpenter's book when it was finally out, other than doing what I'm sure Diana did as well, and that's sift your way through letters and diaries and
manuscripts,
scraps of information, and slowly put together a picture of what the group was. And that's really been it. It took a long, long time, and that's the only way to do it, really, wasn't
Absolutely.
It, at that time?
Yes.
So I had, it's really odd that I went to Turkey and met these Americans who were all discovering Lewis and the Inklings through, you know, people like Clyde S. Kilby, mm-hmm. who I think is one of the great pioneers in Lewis and Tolkien and Inkling studies. He took the trouble to get to know Lewis and Tolkien and other Inklings and get stuff to Wheaton and he was a great encourager. Though I never met him, he wrote to me and stuff like that. He encouraged me. So that's how it all started.
Okay.
Well, I think I'd like to add on to what they said and then bring in as well the power of communities like this, because I think the most influential works on me have been works in progress. So one, for instance, is Greville Lindop's biography. Well, you say, wasn't that just published, like, last week? Well, October last year. But Greville has been working on it for over a decade, and he's been extremely generous. And I've been in touch with him since pretty early on in the process, and he's shared bits and pieces of it with me. And those of you who have seen the Chapel of the Thorns see that he took his section on Chapel from his biography, and he and I revised it together and made it into the preface to that book. So just being aware of what he was doing and sort of learning at a distance how he was doing this, sort of finding out about archives and manuscript work at a distance, was extremely helpful. And then 4 years ago when I was here at Taylor, in this community, was so inspiring that immediately after that went to the Wade and worked on Chapel of the Thorn, and that's the same time as many of you heard that Brenton made the Screwtape discovery. So that was another instance of sort of collaboration and mutual inspiration. And I also had many wonderful interactions with Chris Mitchell, and there was one particular conversation that we had that was just so encouraging, and he sat me down and asked me, what are your goals, what are your interests, and he pretty much told me to stick with Charles Williams because he knew that there weren't really enough people working on that, and he put me in touch with several other people who were doing Williams' work as well. So just a couple other influential books. Planet Narnia was very influential on me, and again, it was as a work in progress. I heard Michael Ward give a talk on it way before, you know, the word was even out that he had made this discovery. So that's been a real blessing and influential on my work.
We used to hear about Planet Narnia because Michael shared at the last colloquium that the very first teaching he ever did, the very first Lewis teaching, was teaching for the Taylor University January term that I used to take over. And my students would all come back and present papers on Narnia, and it was always basically just warmed over Michael Ward, Planet Narnia stuff, 6 to 8 years before the book came out. Let me ask a question that I didn't tell anyone, that I didn't warn anyone I'd ask. And it's a simple one. Other than your own work, because I know you're all writers, so you're reading your own work a lot in the work of revision. But what are you reading right now, especially in the field of Inkling studies? But, of course, if it's relevant to your work in Inkling studies and outside of that, what are you reading right now that you want to tell suggest to all of us, you know, this is something you really should be looking at yourselves, okay? Why don't we start with Serena this time? We'll come back the other way, all right?
Well, I'm actually just about to finish my chronological read-through and blog-through of Charles Williams, so that's kind of a big priority to me. I want to finish that before I start my work at Baylor in the fall. So I'm just reading the last few books that Williams wrote, reading or rereading, and preparing to blog on those. But, Carol, I'm actually just reading your book right now. I've got the audio version, and I think I'm about a quarter to a third of the way through it. So that's really great, and we're going to talk about themes in Inkling Scholarship soon, and I'll come back to that. But Carol's book has one of the most important themes that's going on right at this exact moment in Inkling Studies, and I'll come back to it. So if you haven't read it yet, do.
Colin?
Just before I left England, I was reading a book which I couldn't bring with me because of the weight of my suitcase, and that's Stephen Thorson's book on Barfield, which I'm finding delightfully lucid and helpful in trying to get an overview of his thinking, and particularly to try and understand the kind of philosophical categories that Lewis would fit into as he developed, because it's really tricky trying to find out how much he was an idealist and how much he was a realist and things like that, you know, if you know a bit about philosophy. Also, I've been reading tons and tons of books by Dorothy L. Sayers, because I'm currently working on a book about her where I'm trying to pull together her many different aspects, such as a dramatist, a crime writer, and a translator of Dante, and a popular theologian, and somebody whose prose and conversation is always filled with lots of quotes from people that you wonder where they came from, and you would like somebody to have annotated all the quotations. It would be a lifetime's job, I think. So that's where I am at the moment.
I'm afraid my answer will tell you more about me than Lewis studies. My daughter is 14 years old, and as she was growing up, it was our habit to read to her constantly. So we read to her a half an hour in the morning and half an hour in the evening. Now that she's 14, she likes to read to me. And this has been a tremendous privilege to see the books that she loves best through her perspective. So we've just finished, for the very first time for me, Harry Potter, the whole series. And her favorite author right now is an author named Rainbow Rowell. Does anybody know Rainbow Rowell? And she's been reading Rainbow Rowell's Fangirl to me. And it's very, very interesting, the kinds of conversations that are sparked when your children read to you. And you get to ask them, what do you notice and how do you feel about that? How do you feel about the choices that these characters are making? What would you say if you were on the scene and could speak into this situation and so on? So we've been doing a lot of that. My own reading has been related to two projects that I'm working on. One, a book on Dante that I'm very, very excited about. I've been on sabbatical for the last semester working on a book about Dante. I think Dante is incredibly important to all of the Inklings. Mm-hmm. I think Dante's influence has been vastly underestimated, particularly on Lewis's thought and his worldview. We talk about Lewis's medieval point of view, but we don't talk specifically enough about his work on Dante and the influence of specific scenes and even phrases in Dante, and so I'm very grateful, Marcia, for your book on that. The other thing I've been working on a bit is I'm finally very excited because I can see the finish line of a project I've been working on for a while called The Major and the Missionary, A Love Story, which is a fascinating project about Warren Lewis and his correspondence with a missionary doctor that he became pen pals with late in life. These letters are fascinating. You start with some inquiries, they become pen friends, and then she gets a little flirty. And it's quite interesting to watch their unfolding romance and to follow the trajectory of their profound relationship that occurred, both of them late in life, but really very influential to both of them. So I've been reading a lot about missions, Papua New Guinea, where Blanche Wow. Biggs was stationed, and trying to understand a little bit about what it meant to be a missionary doctor in that time. She was at the very cutting edge of the ecumenical movement in that country, and to watch her efforts to not only make a difference as a missionary and as a doctor, but also as someone who is trying to promote a kind of mere Christianity and a kind of collaboration among the various groups that were stationed there has been fascinating for me.
Let's switch then to the future of Inkling Studies, or new directions in Inkling Studies, or however you want to frame that. We can dream, we can complain, we can make a short list, however we want to think about this, all right? So let's start with Colin this time, and then get everybody a chance.
You're up.
I suppose up to now my gripe has been that a lot of studies have been on individual members of the Inklings, and usually there's just four picked out, you know, Tolkien, Lewis, Barfield and Charles Williams, whereas in fact there's lots of other colourful characters in the in the group. But I think now it's changed. I think I said to Diana that last year was the year of the Inklings, wasn't it?
Yes.
Or you might have said it and I picked it up. But it's amazing to see all these books coming out of the Inklings. You know, I've been working for years on things and suddenly Carol's book came out and all kinds of others, and Bandersnatch and my book on the Oxford Inklings and Greville Lindop on Charles Williams, who we've been working on for 9 or 10 years, I think. And things are changing. And I think one area that I'd like to see more work on is we know that the Inklings was a writing group. In his early days, Lewis described it as being characterized by a tendency to write on Christianity. Yes. And his brother Warren definitely preferred the writing group to the conversational group, which formed. But I would like to see more done on the other Inklings group, which is the same group but as but focusing upon conversation, which is also important when they were reading. And I think you can get a hint of the power of the conversation in Humphrey Carpenter's reconstruction of a conversation, which everybody seems to like or hate in his biography of the group. And I know Barfield really enjoyed the conversations, and Lewis was a conversationalist, and a number of people have pointed out, who knew Lewis very well, that his wonderful letters, you know, we've got these three massive volumes of them now, actually echo a lot of his actual conversations. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think this group here, all of you, will be aware of how conversation isn't playing so much of a part in our culture as it has in the past. And you can go to certain places where you still get that power of conversation. So we can ignore Warren a bit and say that the conversation group was also important. I mean, they kept going to the pub, the Eagle and Child and other pubs, week after week, and talk, and it lasted right into the 50s, until towards the very end of the 50s, C.S. Lewis was wondering what the group identity was now that Tolkien no longer came and Charles Williams was no longer around. So there was the whole metaphysical question of what makes a constant identity of anything, us or a group or a society, when things are always changing. You know, all the cells in our body are supposed to change every 7 years. I don't know if that's true, but we somehow manage to remain ourselves despite all those changes, and similarly with groups. So I would love to see more work on the conversational side. It would be hard work, you know, like it was for people who have written on the group and having to, you know, do an archaeological dig on the letters and diaries and so on. But I think it would be very worthwhile. Got a couple of other things, but
go ahead. We have this is our last big thing, and then we're going to open up for questions. So let's give it a good shot.
I touched on this on the beginning, but I'd like to see more work on the other Inklings. There's a group with over the 30 years or so that was made up of 20 or so people and perhaps more. And as far as I know, I don't know whether it was entirely consistent, but to come along to the conversation group in the pub, you still had to be invited. It wasn't just a matter of barging in. You might find some interesting person in the corner who turned out to be a right-wing poet who looked like Strider, who got dragged in for just a couple of occasions. Generally, the Inklings were a noisy lot in the corner of the pub and probably surprised people by the racket. There are some people that, if you say that they might have been an Inkling to get into a real trouble, you know, tutting and everything. One of them is Roger Lansdowne Green. He actually attended quite a few gatherings of the Inklings in pubs. Most of the other time he didn't, because he wasn't living in Oxford. He was right up in Cheshire in his ancestral home. And he played a very important part in Lewis's development of the Narnian Chronicles. And everything he wrote really fits into the ethos of the Inklings. Mm-hmm. So I'd like, I suppose I'll just have to develop a thick skin and mention him more. But there's lots of others, people who wrote about Hadrian's Wall in, you know, in historical books and all kinds of these subjects. It's a bit like some of the older groups that got together around Dr. Johnson and others, where there'll be people with all different areas of expertise. They weren't all Oxford dons from, you know, from the English department in Oxford. They're wide variety and then professional people, and they added so much to each other's knowledge. And I think they were a remarkable group, like some of the groups, you know, the Black, the Blue Stockings and other groups. So I'd like to see more work on the other Inklings. And yeah, I mean, it'll be hard work finding information, but some people are really good at that, you know. And then finally, some of the what you might call satellites of the Inklings, people who aren't actually members, people like Dorothy L. Sayers and others, that have huge affinities with the group. And it's really good to see so much work being done on her now. You know, such a major writer. And there's many others as well that can be explored. I mean, somebody like Cecil Harwood, who was one of the anthroposophist friends of Owen Barfield, who became a deep friend of Lewis. In fact, his son, Lawrence, became one of Lewis's godsons. And he's written a very interesting book about Lewis and as his godfather. As far as I remember, Lewis would visit and he'd crawl on the floor with the kids and things and, you know, have a good time. He's not at all, you know, the kind of image you have of him. So there's these satellite people. And Cecil Harwood, for example, was described by the group of walkers in the 20th century as the Lord of the Walks, because he used to organise the walks. So it's rather nice to hear that, isn't it? It might echo something else that took place later on. So I think that's all.
Of course, one of the purposes of the way we conceived of the colloquium this year was to pick up some of those satellites and extend the circle of friends. And I don't know, you know, we couldn't all get to every session, but, you know, we had a session on C.S. Lewis and Fred Hoyle, kind of like the anti-friend. And a wonderful session, a wonderful paper on Lewis and Wagner. And, of course, not everyone could have been there. But, and of course, that brings in Cecil Harwood, because if Lewis was going to hear Wagner, he was probably going with Harwood. And there's just so many good papers. And Sayers, of course, we had two entire sessions on Sayers. And so it's just really, really been encouraging that this is sort of the way we were conceiving of doing things, trying to do things this year, and it really has worked in that way, at least. Serena, do you want to give this a go?
Sure.
Thanks.
Thank you. Well, I see three very exciting things happening, and so my dream is really just that they would continue to happen and to gain momentum and personnel and so forth. And the first I alluded to previously is the idea of looking at the Inklings as modernists. Mm. Because I think there was a time that the only place you could give a paper on an Inkling was either an Inklings conference or the Tolkien at Kalamazoo sessions. So you had to look at Tolkien's medievalism. Now, maybe that's just my impression and sort of overstating the case. But for a long time, really, all the books that were coming out, a lot of the studies were looking at their sources, were having them as backwards-looking characters, right? So even when we were talking about how to put the Inklings and King Arthur together, at one stage I was thinking, do I need to organize the book according to their sources? So do we need to move the book through, you know, the Welsh sources and move it on and get to Malory? No, because that's not really the way that they were looking at Arthur, because they were engaged in this contemporary conversation, right? And so that's why in my talk I mentioned the other 20th century British writers who were all working on Arthur. So I think it's very important to look at them in their modernist context, and I want to see studies of Williams and Joyce and more stuff on Lewis and Eliot, and I want to see a lot more on their modernist context, and I want to see a lot more on them as war poets, right? I mean, Lewis fought in the war, was wounded, and published a volume of poetry in 1919. So why aren't we talking about him in the exact same sentence with Sassoon and Owen and so forth, right? And then even Williams, who didn't fight, still has so many poems about the war and on its effects on the home front and on the people that he lost. So that's a really important topic that we need to do more of. So I'd like to see that. The second is that I really love how the critical conversation is moving forward. Yes. And how more and more scholars are picking up on the big critical themes of the latter half of the 20th century and the critical conversations that are going on right now. So there's a lot more going on with the Inklings and gender studies and environmental studies, looking at post-colonial implications of their work, you know, like Williams's Empire and so forth. So that's really important, and we need to keep that going, and we need to do it not just to be sort of popular in academia, but because these are really, really important critical questions. And we can add those to the more common ones of the theological conversations and the source material and so forth. And the last one is finding more of a place for the Inklings in academia and especially in education. I want to see more and more courses on them taught on the university level. And there are whole programs that are developing. You know, obviously I'm here promoting Signum University as well, so that's my little edge. But we want to see that these authors are being taken seriously, and we don't want to see the line between the academic and the popular, right? Because over and over and over again, when surveys are done about what are the best books of the 20th century, The Lord of the Rings wins over and over again. The surveyors keep trying to ask the question in a different way, so he might win. Right? And that doesn't work. He just always wins. And yet the Academy still has this idea that, you know, if it's popular, it mustn't be good literature. Okay, who has had more of an impact on more minds, Joyce or Tolkien? Right? Who has been read more? Now, if I ask you who's been studied more, that would fall down differently. But if I just say you're walking through the mall and you're just asking people who's read Joyce or who's read Tolkien or who's seen the movie, well, yeah. So if we're just talking about number of minds who have encountered some of this content, then it's pretty clear. So I would like to see these authors on more and more college and grad school syllabi.
I often think looking at Victorian poetry, which I do sometimes in a Brit Lit class, and I always tell the students, when I studied it in grad school, we never studied Elizabeth Barrett Browning, even though she was the most popular poet of the Victorian age. But she wasn't critically accepted by the scholarship in the way that her husband was, and the way that Matthew Arnold was, and how many people in the 19th century read Elizabeth Barrett Browning versus Matthew Arnold. It's a huge gulf between them, and she wins. So the same thing applies. It's not just to Inklings, but okay. Diana, do you want to take a stab at this?
No, I would love to. I think there are several topics that I'm really excited about in terms of Inkling studies. I am really excited to see more on Lewis's family. So I'm excited that Don King is working on a biography of Warren Lewis. I hope that my work on Warren Lewis, especially the later part of his life, will help us to understand and perhaps rehabilitate our understanding of that man. I'm very excited about Crystal Hurd and her look at Lewis's parents. I think Flora Lewis needs a lot more attention. I think we need to understand her. She's an outstanding individual. Another topic I think that needs a lot of in-depth attention is this whole issue of women and C.S. Lewis, just in its broadest sense. Now, there's a great collection that came out recently, as most of you know. Many of you contributed to that. And I think that it's good, but I think it's a bit piecemeal. And I think that we are really ready. I think that we're really poised to have extended and sophisticated and thoughtful looks at this this issue. I think it's time. A third topic that's come up a number of times in conversations here is just that we seem ready for some truly in-depth analysis of Lewis's individual works. And I'm really grateful for that. Honestly, I would point to the setting of the C.S. Lewis stone in Poets Corner at Westminster Abbey as a kind of watershed moment for the possibility of treating Lewis's work much more seriously than we ever have before. I think that we are there. If there's ever something that gives us an invitation to look at his works much more critically, in the very best sense of that word, it was that moment. So those are some topics that I would like us to address as a community. But I think there are some bigger issues, and if I could rabble-rouse just a little bit. There are two things I'm very concerned about, and that's how we conduct ourselves as scholars. One thing that I think we have to admit is that the publishing industry is broken. And it's very, very difficult, increasingly difficult for us to do the work that we do and to get it out and to make it available without incredible difficulty in working with publishers and so forth. I think that we are poised to come up with some more creative ways of making our work available. And what I would like to propose is that perhaps we can be alert to opportunities to create micro-publishers that would be very happy to publish small numbers of significant works so that we can continue for the very best scholarship to go forward, but without having to meet the demands of the numbers of volumes that are required for these things to become viable from a publisher's point of view. I'm very concerned about how the work that we do here gets out and becomes more widely available, and I want to see us be much more inventive. The other way I'd like to be much more inventive is how we collaborate. Now, it won't surprise you to know that I'm very interested in creative collaboration, but I've been coming to academic conferences for a very long time. This is the very first one that I've ever attended that had on its first day the opportunity for authors to get together in a roundtable setting and simply talk about what we're working on in a large public setting. And even a session like this, I mean, look who's here. Am I the only one who looks around and says, oh, it's my bookshelf, come to life?
You know?
It's like, look who's here. Can we find inventive ways to do a better job of supporting one another in the work that we do, of simply informing one another? Here's what I'm working on. Oh, did you know so-and-so has an interest in that? Or did you hear the paper that was given at Kalamazoo? No, I wasn't able to be there. How can we do a better job of encouraging one another, resourcing one another, challenging one another to stay the course? Because this is hard. And it's lonely sometimes, the work that we do. How can we do a better job of challenging one another in the very best sense of bringing out the best work from one another simply by making our papers and our presentations, even our drafts, available before they go to print and really having each other's back in terms of our creative collaboration?
Thanks, Tim.
We're going to open it for questions. I don't think I'm going to try to pass this around. Just yell out your question, or I may repeat it. I just want to say one thing, just give a shout out to some people here. Serena herself with the Odyssey Inkling blog. I know Brenton blogs at Pilgrim and Narnia. I'm always seeing new stuff people are working on, the kind of thing Diane is talking about, stuff that people are working on. I see it at places like that. William O'Flaherty with Essential C.S. Lewis, is that one of them? I don't know how many blogs you have. The Essential C.S. Lewis. So there's just a little bit of a tip of an iceberg here. We're getting some of this done. I'm seeing some work that people are doing in progress or embryonic state even, and they're kind of just throwing it out there. That's helpful. And I want to thank those people because in one way we can do this sort of thing, this kind of collaboration is everybody. What do we call it? Like them on Facebook or subscribe to their blogs or whatever it is. And if you want to know my blog, okay. No. Question right here.
Yes, and my question basically stems off of what you just said and what Diana just said. Serena, you have an excellent blog on Charles Williams, and recently you've been featuring guest posts from a variety of scholars. Going through works of Williams. I was wondering if you could comment on the blog in general as a forum for the exchange of scholarship and the marketplace of ideas, community of scholars, or other online forums. Maybe we need a Facebook of Inkling Scholars, something like that. Anyway, I wanted you to comment on that.
Somebody pass that down.
Oops. Thank you. Thanks for that excellent question. Well, I'll start with the sort of negative side of it and then move to the more positive, which is that the online world is still very fragmented. I'm still really surprised to find out, how many other people are working on Charles Williams and they don't know about my blog and I don't know about their stuff. So that's really discouraging, especially when we really should just be able to all Google each other and just find it. Right, and that's partly, sometimes it's maybe generational or technological that some people aren't as comfortable moving around the internet and finding all the different areas. So I'm not sure how to unify all of that, because everybody has their favorite platforms and their favorite ways. So share your ideas. You know, tell us your ideas for how we can not centralize, but network all of these things.
Charlie Starr.
Diana, following up on what you said about a new kind of publishing, I just want to give props to Bob Trexler and Wink Lock.
Yes.
Published a very good new book on David Neuhauser. I don't know if
anybody's
seen that yet.
That Charlie Starr wrote.
Oh, I know. Charlie Starr as well.
Disclaimer.
Paul Michelson.
Following up on what Serena said, Diana mentioned the publishing industry is broken, so is academia. people who are coming up for tenure, and they have to fight to even get the slightest recognition for digital humanities work.
Yes.
Some of it is very substantial. Right. I'm talking about geographical gazetteers and stuff like that. The difference is it's online, not in book form, and these people have to fight to get any recognition that this is serious academic work. I don't know any solutions to that, other than I guess we just keep supporting people who are doing these things, but that's another problem we have to confront.
Mm-hmm. Question. Marcia.
One comment for Serena on the blog business. Those of you who know about each other, could you put some links to other people's blogs?
Yes.
And then, okay.
So yeah, and some of us have that. We do have blog roles down the side, but Devin, I think, wants to follow up with that.
I don't have a new question.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and then a question for Diana on when you say you're working on Dante and the Inklings. One chapter on each guy in Dante, or what were you thinking of?
I'm going to repeat the question. So the question is to Diana, when she is working on Dante, when she says she's working on Dante, is she working on one chapter for each of the Inklings and their response to Dante, or what's the organizational principle there?
Yeah, my work on Dante is inspired by the Inklings, but it's actually not about the Inklings. It's really about Dante.
Oh.
And it comes out of my... I fell in love with Dante in a really, really big way more than 20 years ago, and it's a book that I read and study at least once every year and have for those two decades.
Okay.
And when I share my passion for Dante, it's often the case that people's surprisingly do not share my love of this book. So I want to rehabilitate Dante by writing a book that will invite people to enjoy it as much as I do. Mm-hmm. And so that's my goal in writing that. I think that Dante is incredibly relevant and powerful, but I think it can also be obscure. And so my approach is to take a spiritual formation reading of Dante. And so you think about maybe Richard Foster meets, literary criticism would be kind of the approach that I'm taking in that
so
particular
it
book.
It wouldn't really be on the Inklings
no.
to say, thanks.
That's interesting in light of, Robert Moore Jumonville back here, who gave us the sort of C.S. Lewis problem of prayer, but really from a spiritual formation perspective. And I mean, and that leads me to something about generalism, and we heard an amazing paper opening day, basically in praise of David Neuhauser, but also in a larger picture, from Chris Smith, the editor of Inglewood Review of Books, on the joys and the benefits of being a generalist. And of course, that's hard to define, and he went into all that. But Dave Neuhauser was a math prof, and we wouldn't be here without him. And quit it. my good friend Chris Armstrong is a church historian, 19th century American, or 20th century American, which is it?
19th.
Yeah. And he runs a work project in Wheaton College, a work think tank, a vocation think tank. But he wrote a book that is about how evangelicals of our age, which he is one, so that may not be addressing all of us, but he's addressing people like himself who maybe need to learn something from the Middle Ages. And his way of doing it, this may seem cynical, I don't know, his way of doing it was to approach that through C.S. Lewis. It's like reading medieval wisdom, as it were, through the eyes of C.S. Lewis. And I thought it's not quite the same as some of the kind of scholarship we're talking about. But that's a really, really interesting thing. It sounds a little bit like what Diana's doing. I know it's what Robert's doing. And it's what Dave Neuhauser did. So that's another area we can kind of be working it. Jennifer, question.
Yeah,
and then you, Devin.
Can I do a quick commercial?
No. Devin?
Yeah.
Jennifer's my second best friend in the world, and the first is her husband, so I'm just joking with her.
No, I was picking up on that, actually. I'm the editor of Christian History Magazine, and we did an issue on the seven authors at the Wade Center using material from the Wade Center with lists of resources that, you know, where you should start if you've never read this author before, where you should start if you want to go deeper, websites, the whole thing, you know, trying to gather as much of that, you know, connections, a timeline of all the connections between the authors. So if you're interested in something that at least attempts to begin to pull this whole world together, talk to me.
Yeah, if you haven't seen that issue, it is a great...
And Joe's quoted.
It's a great starter, and we've given away over 100 issues of that here this year. And, Jen, how many people in this room wrote in that particular...
Yeah, I think almost everyone that wrote on the road, wrote or was interviewed for that article is in this room.
Yeah, so there you go. including Colin, and, you know, Chris, by the way, is the editor of Christian History. Jennifer's managing editor.
Yeah,
she does the work.
She has the ideas, and I do the work.
And, you know, that is a wonderful resource. That just get your church or somebody, you know, to order 30. Really, if you want to do a little inkling seminar.
HistoryMagazine.org.
Yeah, okay. Devin Brown.
So, I have the privilege, and you can have too, of having Colin come into your classroom every semester through the lovely bonus materials at the end of the Lord of the Rings and Narnia films. And I wonder, that's another way besides, we're talking about the print way, but what about a video way? I'm just curious. Have you? What kind of impact has that had? Because there's resources. Those people have money. Those things were done very well. They were able to have the best of scholarship there. And what you said, you come into the classroom and students get fired up. Would you say just a bit about that other way of bringing inklings to the world?
So I'm going to repeat the question. What about using film, the actual films that have been made, and also DVDs, things like that, as a help?
And talk about the bonus material, the documentaries that go with
right,
it.
Right, right.
There's the scholarship.
Okay. Does Colin want to, or anybody?
I'll give this to Colin in a minute, but I want to add to that the idea of Skyping into each other's classrooms. Mm. And I've had some fantastic opportunities to be present via the technology, talking with students in various settings. And so when you think about making these connections, what you're seeing right here is an exciting opportunity for us to do better collaboration.
Colin?
Yes, I'm trying to remember how I got into them, because I've done a number of that kind of interviewing. The BBC, for example, they've often asked me to talk about Lewis or Tolkien. But with the case of the Lord of the Rings DVDs, the reason I was asked was Brian Sibley had been asked to do the interviewing, and he's a friend of mine. He knows my work, and I know his work. And so I was whisked into this posh hotel in London and nearly met Christopher Lee, but not quite. He was but that was a lunch break, so I missed him, unfortunately. But I was very excited to do that. And there was another important project. It's called... it was a PBS documentary about Freud and C.S. Lewis. I just forgot the question of God. Yes, and that was a highly professional. The group of people that put that together, they sent me a whole load of questions to think about so that I could be prepared. And we did the filming in the kilns, and similarly with the Walt Disney big edition of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. They had a documentary on there. And that was filmed at the kilns and in C.S. Lewis's church and everything like that. And to me, that was a wonderful opportunity. In none of the cases did I get any money, except for them from the BBC. They paid me. But the New Line Cinema just sent me a wonderful letter thanking me for my part in the making of The Lord of the Rings. So maybe that's worth something. I don't know. But they you know, they had the argument that it's a platform for you. And that was true of it, you know.
Exposure.
You had the, you know, all the actors on it and everything. They didn't get paid either, so you know, they just, it was just seen as a platform. Actually, I probably shouldn't have said this, should I? Rub it off, please. Yeah. But anyway, but it was well worthwhile doing, you know, because, and it helped. Sometimes you go in a bookshop and people say, "Hey, I've seen you somewhere," or something. Yeah. Anyway, but it is a huge. I couldn't afford myself to do a video recording. You need such high quality.
Yes.
And everybody expects the highest standard when it comes to even voice, as you found with your your audio book of Bandersnatch.
Yes.
Has to be done very professionally, doesn't
right.
it? And so when an outside body has got all the expertise, you know, comes along and asks you to do it, you just do it.
Yes.
I do want to say, everyone, for us to say goodbye to this session, so let's thank our panelists one more time.
Thanks for listening to this special edition of All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty. You just heard Diana Glier, Colin Duryea, and Serena Higgins from the panel discussion at the 2016 Taylor Colloquium, an event held every 2 years at Taylor University in Indiana. Diana and Colin have been on my show several times before, and you can find in the show notes links to them. Also in the show notes are direct links for most of the books mentioned at the beginning of the panel discussion. You can find those show notes either at EssentialCSLewis.com or allaboutjack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast is more easily found. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. The other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, provides links back to the audio files, but also has other features that include a variety of articles related to Lewis. These are such as a daily fact and quote related to him. Then also I've been doing a series examining quotations attributed to Lewis that may not necessarily be from him. At the time this podcast is first posted, I also recently shared a couple of shows that were brief talks from the 2016 Taylor Colloquium. I shared my talk related to the Screwtape Letters, and also a talk from Britton Dickinson, where he shared a surprising link between those letters and what is commonly known as the Space or Ransom Trilogy. In addition to these new shows, I also post previously released podcasts on my iTunes feed that you can also find at the Podbean address. If you don't know how to find the show on iTunes, then be sure to check the show notes for a direct link. Again, those notes can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or allaboutjack.podbean.com. Finally, speaking of Screwtape, my book C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters, is available online at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. You can learn more about it by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com.